Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends. Welcome, Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live coast to coast, border to border. Oh, George W. Bush today deciding this is really incredible when you look at the big picture, the kind of the grand scheme of things, and the Bush administration had decided they needed a topic, right? They needed to change the subject. They needed to change the subject as fast as they could because they were having, a bit of a problem. You know, the war isn't doing all that well. Not just the war. I mean, the war in Iraq, the so-called war on terrorism. You've got Karl Rove about to be indicted, Scooter Libby about to be indicted. You've got, in all probability, George Bush and Dick Cheney perhaps being unindicted co-conspirators involved in all this stuff. I mean, all these things are happening all at once. Bush comes out, he gives a speech about, you know, be afraid, terror, 9-11 Iraq, 9-11 Iraq, does his little, basically his be afraid thing, it just didn't seem to work. I mean, at one point in time, it worked. But a couple days ago, he did it, and it just didn't seem to work. And so, you know, you'll recall this little montage from his speech before the Republican National Committee, just as an example. This was, you'll recall, John Kerry said, you know, John Kerry reporting for duty, and it was a positive, upbeat speech before the DNC. Bush goes before the RNC. And,
be afraid, September the 11th. We saw tragedy arrive on a quiet morning. The evil terrorists, September the 11th. Danger, doom, danger, doom, killers. Be afraid, evil. The world will drift toward tragedy. Tragedy. May God bless you. Evil God. Iraq, Afghanistan, and Iraq. Evil darkness. God. The continuing danger of terrorism.
So, you know, on it goes like that. You know, so that wasn't working. And so they say, you know, well, we've got to change the subject. We have to come up with something else. And so, how about taxes? Taxes is always a good, reliable thing. Let's fall back on taxes. Let's go to taxes. And so they appoint a commission to look into taxes. And a nice presidential commission looks into taxes and says, should we have tax, you know, should we change our tax laws? Should we have tax breaks? You know, what should we do? And they came up with their recommendations today. And I guarantee you, this is going to go over really well with the major donors to the Republican Party. I mean, the Mars family, the Walton family, the multimillionaires and billionaires in America, they're going to be very happy with this. But I somehow think the Republicans once again are shooting themselves in the foot. This is from the Associated Press. A presidential panel says tax breaks that promote home ownership and encourage businesses to give workers health insurance should be changed. Now, they say to help more middle-income families, right? Yeah. What they want to do is they want to cut back on the amount of money you can deduct on your home interest deductions. And they want to cut back on the amount of money that small businesses can deduct when they pay for people's health care expenses. Now, they're going to spin this as, oh, isn't this a wonderful thing that we're doing? Aren't we generous? The Bush administration shoots themselves in the foot one more time. What a surprise. In the meantime, the so-called war on terror is continuing, and it's continuing to draw some victims. And among those victims, in a very serious way, very problematic, very, very difficult for them. There's like no shortage, basically, of victims in the category of people around the world who are victims of this, but also American citizens and folks in the military. We have with us Captain James Yee. He has a new book out, For God and Country, Faith and Patriotism Under Fire. James Yee, welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Just for people who are not familiar with who you are and what was up, what was your position down in Guantanamo Bay?
Oh, I was the Muslim chaplain assigned to Camp Delta.
And you were an officer in the, what was it, the Army?
A graduate of West Point and officer in the United States Army.
That's right. Okay. And you were working there at Guantanamo Bay. Can you give us an eyewitness point of view on how the detainees were being treated there?
Yeah, this is something I chronicle in detail in my book. You know, the conditions that the detainees were being held under and my observations of especially what kind of state of mind or that they're in today, or actually it was 2 years ago now. But, you know, I observed a lot of things that were very disturbing.
For example?
For example, detainees were so depressed to the point that two of them were permanent residents of the hospital because they just simply refused to eat anymore.
We have over 100 of them now on a hunger strike, you know.
Well, I've seen the current news of the growing hunger strike in which 18 to 21 are now being force-fed. Back when I was there, there were two being force-fed with a tube that gets
through their nose and down into their stomach.
After being lubed by petroleum jelly, the prisoner is shackled to the hospital bed. A guard holds back his forehead. It's not a very comfortable experience for the prisoner. It's actually very painful.
Ouch. How far from reality has our media been in reporting on these? I call them concentration camps at Guantanamo Bay. I don't know what else to call them. I mean, if you go by the administration's rationale that during war you take prisoners as enemy combatants, then when the war is over you have to release them. And these folks were captured on the field of battle in Afghanistan, and that war theoretically is over. I mean, there's a new government in Afghanistan. We've turned the keys back over to that government. Hamid Karzai is supposed to be in charge of the country. So it seems to me that these folks have not been, you know, their situation has not been resolved the way that the Geneva Conventions would require, and they've not been charged with crimes. So it's, would you go so far as to call this a concentration camp?
Well, what I would say is, yeah, those issues are being highly debated at the in our highest courts. Supreme Court has ruled on some issues. The federal district and appeals courts are ruling on, you know, the status of enemy combatants. How exactly does Geneva apply or not apply? All that stuff is really, really heatedly being debated today, and is a concern for many of those that I have met in our legal profession.
How disconnected from reality is our media with regard to the situation down there?
Yeah, what I would say about the media comes down every week. Different people in the media come down every week to get a look at the camp. But for sure, they don't get to see what is really going on in the camp. There's a whole spin, you might say, that the military puts on things. And I was actually being used in that manner to some degree because I interviewed with the journalists on a weekly basis.
You were the friendly face of the military.
You know, I was there to represent the issues of Islam and Muslims in the military. And, of course, many of the journalists wanted to, you know, get my comments. And, you know, I write about this in the book that, you know, I told about how prisoners had Korans, they had halal meat, they had meal schedules changed to accommodate Ramadan. But for sure, you don't get to see the prisoners' conditions themselves, and the deterioration of their state of mind or the harshness that they're suffering through.
Yeah, these people who have not been charged with any crimes.
Even the VIPs who came down, congressional people who came down also to visit, they don't get to see what they want to see. They get to see what the military shows them.
Interesting.
And they used to be referred to as dog and pony shows because, you know, they didn't really see the reality of the camp itself.
We're speaking with James Yee, his new book, For God and Country, Faith and Patriotism Under Fire. Beautiful, beautiful book, by the way. It's a very, very well done and some really startling insights into the situation. How did you endure the anti-Muslim view in Guantanamo Bay, the anti-Muslim bias that seems to have so infected our soldiers?
How did I view it or endure it?
How did you endure it? How did you deal with it?
Yeah, you know, I converted to Islam in 1991, and, you know, I have had experiences with anti-Muslim sentiment and hostility, feelings being stereotyped, etc. But I've always been someone who's been able to effectively connect with people on a personal level and communicate with them in an effective manner. And that had always helped me in a positive way to show, you know, really the religion of Islam, and that it is far removed from extremism or anything related in any way to terrorism.
Yeah. We're talking with James Yee, his book For God and Country. We normally would be taking a break right now, but we're going to push this back just a little bit. I just have a couple more quick questions for you, if that's okay. Where were you when you were arrested without being charged? What were the conditions that you were held in for 76 days?
Right. Actually, I was arrested and thrown in jail for 76 days, isolated in a cell. I was being accused of spying, espionage, aiding the enemy, capital crimes. I was being threatened with the death penalty.
Were you being accused of these in a legal fashion, or simply, you know, people saying that this is what you might be accused of? In other words, was there actually an indictment against you?
I would say both. Because mm-hmm. the official memorandum that was written by Major General Jeffrey Miller stated specifically charges and named these charges.
So you were facing the death penalty for something that it turns out you didn't do, you had nothing to do with doing.
The prosecutor actually was threatening me with the death penalty. I wasn't actually officially preferred those charges, but later, 30 days later, what they did eventually charge me with was 2 counts of mishandling classified information. Even that didn't stick because there was no classified information that I had.
Yeah, there was no there. We're talking with James Yee, his new book, God and Country, For God and Country, Faith and Patriotism Under Fire. Finally, was it Captain Yee at your...
Well, I'm actually no longer in the military. I'm completely separated.
Okay, so Mr. Yee, finally, what has been the effect of the false charges on your career and on your life, and where do you plan on going from here?
Obviously, the effect was, especially during the time of the entire ordeal, was devastating for everyone in my family. It shook everybody up. Many of us are, of course, myself and those closest to me, are still recovering. So we're just trying to get back to really some sense of normalcy. Writing the book has actually helped me in that sense. What I try and do is take a positive outlook, apply this idea, what I call emotional intelligence, you know, controlling my emotions and making productive use out of them. And this book is the first step to ensure that I'm doing that, and that what happened to me doesn't ever happen to anyone else.
Yeah, so the book was sort of your catharsis, your recovery, and yet for the rest of us, the book is, I think, at the beginning point. If it's for you, the beginning of the end point. For us, it's the beginning point, a shocking look into this. James Yee, thanks so much for being with us today.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's my pleasure.
I do appreciate it. What you have been through and what you have done, and your willingness now to stand up and speak out in the face of literally having had your life threatened. For speaking out on behalf of peaceful Islam.
Right. The thing is that many Americans around the country are behind me.
There you go. And count me among them. James Yee, thanks for being with us. It's 19 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
So just because he wasn't really elected.
Yeah, just because, you know.
Just because that ballot count wasn't fair.
Yeah, a little fraudulent, you know, just a little.
Just because him and all his friends are millionaires.
It doesn't mean he doesn't care.
Don't care.
And welcome back, my friends. 24 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. It doesn't mean he doesn't care. It's the Tom Hartman program where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, don't think so. Our program brought to you today by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS, smalldog.com on the web. You can get the latest iPods and all things Macintosh, all things computer for that matter. And so it's a great, great organization, good people, and we're pleased to have them as sponsors. Welcome, by the way, to 1240 Talk City in Sacramento, a new affiliate, and to WBLF in State College, Pennsylvania, a new affiliate. And, in fact, we have Jeremy on the line from State College, Pennsylvania. Hey, Jeremy, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom.
Glad to have you here with us. Thanks for listening. What's up?
Sure. I know you love it when sites like Newsmax try to distort truths by changing a word or two in a story after they post it. So I have one for you. U2 was having their concert in Philadelphia on Sunday. They're on their current tour.
U2, the rock band.
Correct. Well, apparently, Rick Santorum rented a luxury box at the arena, and he's charging, you know, CEOs or his buddies or whatever a grand to come in and hobnob with him
for
the fundraiser.
Right.
Which is fine. I mean, people do that. It's legal, whatever.
Sure.
But the story on Newsmax, here's the headline. Bono, U2 perform in Santorum fundraiser.
Ha! I love it.
I know you don't like people reading on air, but I have to read it.
No, that's fine. It's short. That's fine.
Just one sentence for you. The $1,000 a seat concert has been put together by Sean and Anna Wolfington and will take place at the Wachovia Center in Philly in support of Santorum's reelection.
Incredible. Incredible. So they're spinning a U2 and a Bono concert as a Santorum fundraiser.
Yeah, and the kicker is I'm actually going to this concert because I have tickets for it.
Right.
They weren't $1,000 when I bought them, and I went to the Vote for Change shows last year, so I know when you buy a fundraising political concert event, they have to disclaim to you that you're buying a ticket for political purposes.
Sure.
And there was no such thing. But the thing that really kicks me is...
Well, not only that, by the way, you have to disclose to them who you are so that you can be listed as a donor.
Right. But here's the thing, right? That was the way the story was presented on Newsmax yesterday, and there was apparently some backlash about it because it was so egregiously false. I mean, it's just an attempt to make Rick Santorum look cool to young voters by trying to associate him with U2. So the headline now on Newsmax is fundraiser for Senator Rick Santorum at U2 concert. And they changed that one sentence I read you, they changed the word concert fundraiser to concert. So now it says, at a concert of the legendary rock group U2, Senator Rick Santorum will hold a fundraising event.
Yeah, so now at least it's accurate, although it's still implicitly dishonest.
Correct.
Amazing.
I just had to share that with you.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks, Jeremy, for the heads up. I appreciate it. It's great. And thanks for listening to us there on WBLF. Amazing. Amazing. When we come back, we'll have a piggies alert. Mr. Cheney, up to no good again. 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
There you go. That would be a good plan. Welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. 34 and a half past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-TOM, 440-THOM. It's talk radio for the rest of us, exposing the con and conservative and helping you win the water cooler wars with uncommon sense from the radical middle. Tom Hartman here with you. And time for a piggy alert.
Billion pounds, Dr. Calculus.
Well, let me see. That would be 145 million and a half tons of the...
Refuse.
Yeah, refuse. Yes. Per every day, and by the year, let me figure, over 53 million tons of...
Manure?
Manure, yeah. By comparison, the pyramid of the Pharaoh Cheops weighs about 690 million tons, which means that every four and three, you've got a pile of this...
excrement.
Yeah.
Have you seen the bigot piggies in the starched white shed? You will find the bigot piggies stirring up the dirt. Always have clean sheds to play around.
Oh, yeah, sir. Good old Dick Cheney always has a clean shirt, always nicely starched, monogrammed, you know, $150 shirts. And Dick Cheney, in fact, is Halliburton Stock Options. This is our vice president who's drawing an annual payment from Halliburton, roughly equal to the amount of pay that he gets as vice president of the United States. Can you imagine if Al Gore had gotten that? If Al Gore had been drawing a paycheck, had been drawing, well, you know, they say it's not a paycheck. They say it's deferred compensation. But if he had been getting a check every year for $150,000 more or less from anybody, but in particular a company that the government is doing business with, I think, you know, there would be a little bit of outrage. But that's only half of it. Dick Cheney is sitting on top of 433,333 Halliburton stock options. Now, a stock option, an option is something that they very often give to employees as a way of spiffing them. And what it is basically, let's say the company stock is selling for $20 a share, which is roughly what Halliburton was selling for when Bush and Cheney came into office. Let's say it's selling for around $20 a share. You can give the employees, there's two different ways you can give them options. You can give them an option to buy it at the price at the time that the option is given. In other words, you say, okay, anytime you want in the next 5 years, next 10 years, next 1 year, whatever, you can set a time limit on it. You can buy as many shares as you want or up to a certain limit. You can buy 100 shares, 1,000 shares. It's almost never as many shares as you want. It's always a limit. You can buy 1,000 shares, let's say, for example, at $20 because that's the price right now. So a year later, 2 years later, if you do your job well and the company does well, that stock is now trading at $30 or $40. Now you can buy that 1,000 shares for $20 and the next day turn around and sell them for $40 because that's what they're trading for in the open market. So boom, instant profit. Bingo. Right, that's how stock options work. And Dick Cheney was given stock options way back when Halliburton stock was in the teens. It's in the 60s now. It's over 60 bucks. Dick Cheney's stock options, when he originally, you know, just a year ago, I mean, when he originally got them, they were worth a lot less. Just a year ago, were worth $241,498. Now worth more than $8 million. $8 million. Senator Frank Lautenberg, Democrat in New Jersey, released a chart showing the value of Vice President Cheney's holdings in Halliburton just in the past 12 months. As Halliburton has gotten more no-bid contracts in Iraq and more no-bid contracts in the Gulf Coast, in the United States Gulf Coast, right? The Louisiana, New Orleans area, the Mississippi, Alabama. In fact, as Senator Lautenberg said, Halliburton has already raked in more than $10 billion from the Bush-Cheney administration for its work in Iraq, and they were awarded some of the first Katrina contracts. It is unseemly for the vice president to continue to benefit from this company at the same time his administration funnels billions of dollars to it. The vice president should sever his financial ties to Halliburton once and for all. You know, it makes sense to me. I mean, what is this? They're everybody is all upset about Bill Frist. And which, by the way, the whole Bill Frist thing strikes me as really strange. Bill Frist, you've seen the charts. In fact, I think that there was a chart, it might have been in the Wall Street Journal today. It was in one of the papers today. I saw it this morning, where they showed, maybe it was USA Today, where they showed where the stock was in Bill Frist's family, Hospital Corporation of America, where the stock was, and then when he unloaded the stock, how high it had gone, and then it dropped right after that. And the company is run by his brother. His brother's the CEO. It's founded by his father, who's a multi-billionaire. This is one of these private hospital companies. These are the blood-sucking leeches, literally blood-sucking leeches, in that they suck blood, that they draw blood and sell it, that take public hospitals and turn them private and make a profit on you and me and our health care dollars. And Bill Frist has been the Mr. Healthcare in the United States Senate as long as he's been there, sucking our blood. And so the big story appears to be that Bill Frist is simply, you know, was doing insider trading, the same thing that Martha Stewart was accused of, and maybe he should go to jail just like she did, although she ultimately didn't even go to jail for insider trading. She just went to jail for concealing something or lying to the FBI. But in any case, in defense of Bill Frist, weird as this may sound, I suspect something else is going on. And Frist can't talk about it. But here's my suspicion. I may be wrong on this, but this is my guess. Because I don't think that Bill Frist, I don't consider him a man of high ethics, integrity, or honesty. I mean, he's clearly sold out to corporate America right from the get-go. I mean, that, or you could say he is ethical and honest and true to his constituency of millionaires and billionaires. But he doesn't give a damn about the average American, unless it's Terry Schiavo. But that said, consider this timeline. Bill Frist says he's going to run for president. The religious Reich is all excited. They're all agoggle about it. Oh, isn't this wonderful? Bill Frist is going to run for president. He's our guy. He does the whole Terri Schiavo thing. He diagnoses her by television. He says, oh, you know, she doesn't look like she's vegetative to me. Quack, 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 quack. And so everybody's all on the right. They're all excited about him. And then he decides that he's in favor of stem cell research. Because the guy, after all, is a medical doctor. He understands the medicine here. If somebody goes into an in vitro fertilization clinic because they can't get pregnant because their fallopian tubes, the woman's fallopian tubes are scarred up, her ovaries are producing eggs just fine, and her uterus could produce a baby, but the egg can't get from the ovaries to the uterus because the fallopian tubes are messed up, which is a very common problem in America. It's usually caused by chlamydia infection, things like that, other types of low-grade STDs. So anyhow, they go into one of these clinics, these in vitro fertilization clinics. They give them hormones, produce a whole bunch of eggs, draw those eggs out of the ovaries, put them in a petri dish with some of their husband's sperm, and boom, you've got a whole bunch of fertilized eggs. They take one good one out, and they put it in the uterus, and bingo, you've got a baby. What do you do with the rest of them? You've got a bunch of fertilized eggs here. Well, traditionally what they do is they flush them down the sink. There are some people who are willing to pay to have them frozen in liquid nitrogen just in case, you know, dad dies or you know, whatever. They decide, you know, something happens. But, you know, for most people, they just flush them down the sink. And Bill Frist knows this. And these fertilized eggs are the source of stem cells. And they only have to divide into 4, 8, 12, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64, 128 cells. And at that point, boom, you can start pulling stem cells out of them. And they can become any cell in anybody's body. And cure diabetes and spinal cord injury. So anyhow, Frist knows this science, and he knows it's got nothing to do with abortion or, you know, all that kind of stuff. And so he comes out in favor of stem cell research. Well, now the religious right, and Bush is part of that. Now he has slapped George Bush in the face, because George Bush has staked his political reputation on being opposed to stem cell research. And you don't slap George Bush in the face politically without there being considerable pain and consequences, because Bush gets his enemies. If there's anything he knows how to do, it's get his enemies. He's been doing it his whole entire life. It's his favorite thing to do. I mean, he doesn't even like to use laws in courts. I mean, it's just, you know, get your enemies. And so the word starts leaking out. Right after Bill Frist comes out and says that he's in favor of stem cell research, word starts leaking out, and in my opinion, it's leaking out from Bush and Rove. Word starts leaking out that HCA, the Hospital Corporation of America, that Bill Frist's father started and his brother runs, is one of the largest providers of abortions in the United States. In other words, Bill Frist is one of the biggest abortion providers in the country. Well, at that point, Bill Frist freaks out. Now, this is just my guess scenario. I have nothing to back this up other than just observing the coincidence in the timelines. At that point, Bill Frist freaks out and says if he's going to have any political future at all and he still wants to run for president, he's got to disassociate himself from HCA, the Hospital Corporation of America, because HCA does perform abortions in hospitals all across the country. And so he calls up the guy who runs his blind trust, his stockbroker guy, and he says, get rid of all my HCA stock. The guy does it. By coincidence, a week or two later, the stock goes in the tank. And the Bush administration then says, now we're going to investigate Senator Frist. And it was the Bush administration's SEC that investigated him. This is the same SEC that said that they were not going to investigate George W. Bush himself for insider trading with his Harkin Energy shares, even though Democrats in the House and Senate wanted that investigation to happen. So they have the ability to control when the investigation happens. I think this is all about payback. I think Bill Frist is being punished. I think he's being crucified by Bush himself. And because he's a loyal Republican, he can't speak it. That's just my take on it. I may be wrong. It might be that he just, you know, that all of a sudden he got stupid and decided this guy whose father is one of the richest men in America, a multi-billionaire, who himself is a multi-millionaire, suddenly decided he needed a couple hundred thousand extra dollars and he'd engage in felonious insider trading to get it. I mean, that's how it's being played in the media. I don't buy it. I just don't think that Bill Frist is that stupid. And frankly, he had to know everybody was watching. I think he sold his stock because the Bushies were releasing this information about HCA and abortions. And it terrified him. He panicked. And now it's coming back to haunt him. We'll see. We'll see how it all plays out. 45 minutes past the hour, the Tom Hartman radio program, Transforming the World by Revitalizing Democracy.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
What you do and not what you say. If you're not part of the future, then get out of the way.
And welcome back. Welcome back to the radio support group of, by, and for We the People, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-THOM. 1-866-440-TOM. Steve in Indianapolis, Indiana on the line. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hey, I got to thank you. I'm a Republican. I got to thank you for being fair to Bill Frist.
Well, I may be wrong, but I just don't think he's that dumb, and I do know that George Bush is that revengeful, so it just makes sense to me.
Well, I don't think it was Bush, but I exercised a stock option just at the right time. That if it was a lot of money, it would have looked really suspicious, and I was just getting ready to quit, and so I exercised my stock option, and the stocks tanked right after that. So I mean, it looked suspicious, and I had no insider trading.
Yeah.
You know, it happens, you know.
It's just good timing. Yeah. Well, you're welcome. I'm glad I was able to make your day. Logan in New York City on the line. Hey, Logan, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. I have a question about fascism. It seems like you often say that fascism is really how Mussolini defined it. And if it is, why should we be afraid of it?
Because it is what fascism is an institutionalization, really a modern institutionalization of an old system of government called feudalism. And basically what it means is a very small number of people, the very small number of very rich, powerful people get to make all the decisions. And when they do, they make all the decisions in ways that favor them. And the average person like you and me is left out of the equation. It's the death of democracy. That's why we should be afraid of it.
Well, I know, but it just seems like there could be, given benevolent rulers, a fascism that isn't militaristic or bad.
In theory, yeah. And that was the argument, in fact, that Mussolini made, was that by merging corporations and state, you would have such a powerful entity that it would be a good thing that you'd have government continuity. It's also the argument that royalists have made for 1,000 years, that there's this sense of noblesse oblige, that royal families inculcate into their children the fact that they are born with a great burden and an obligation of leadership, and occasionally there are good kings, but not always, and that's why I'm not interested in worrying about whether we have a good king or a good corporation ruling the country. I agree with Thomas Jefferson, who said, I don't look to the rich for the salvation of my country. I will always rely on the people. And that's the bottom line for me. Logan, thanks a lot for the call. Keith in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Keith, what's up?
Hiya, Tom. Hey, I wanted to ask you to comment on 2 points about the Delphi threatened bankruptcy.
Is it threatened? I thought they'd already done it.
I think it's being threatened.
Okay.
But anyway, they're a spinoff of GM, and it appears as if they're going to make demand humongous concessions from their employees, and if it happens, employees will lose their pensions. What I'd like you to speak on is first how Reagan managed to let the corporations control the union pension funds. It seems employees would lose.
Yes, Reagan changed the rules in that regard, and also began the evisceration of the Department of Labor, which is now being run by people who are anti-labor.
And I think
Elaine Chao, for example.
I think Delphi has taken some of this money overseas, so they won't lose it. And second, I see a bit of a parallel here with Reagan figuring out how to loot Social Security and the trust fund? I mean,
well, it was actually Greenspan's suggestion. Ravi Batra wrote a brilliant book outing the whole thing, how in 82, when Reagan did his massive tax cuts and he thought that they would increase government revenue, and it didn't, it threw the country into a huge deficit. The only way that he could continue to spend money like crazy and keep his tax cuts was to borrow money. He had to borrow it from somewhere. And Greenspan said, you can borrow it from the Social Security Trust Fund, and because it's government-to-government borrowing, it won't show up as part of the deficit, even though it has to be paid back. And so you can claim that you don't have a deficit when, in fact, you're borrowing hundreds of billions of dollars. And Reagan started doing that, and every president since then has done that, even including Bill Clinton, by the way. Although, to his credit, Bill Clinton was trying to reach a point where that didn't have to be done, you know, where he could have a budget in surplus. But yeah, that's the bottom line, and well said. 1-866-440-THOM. Scott in San Diego, California. Hey, Scott, what's up?
Good morning, Tom. I studied Jung in college and kind of followed along a lot of that stuff associated with body movements betraying inner psyche.
Yeah, you're talking about Carl Jung, the German psychologist, the Austrian psychologist.
Yes, and it's interesting. This is what Matt Lauer interview on NBC.
Right.
When Bush blink 37 times when asked about Harriet Myers.
Yeah, not only did he blink 37 times, he also licked his lips. There were three weight shifts and some serious foot jiggling. This is in today's Washington Post.
Exactly.
You know, when Lauer asked if Bush, about a slow response to Katrina, Bush blinked 24 times. When asked why Gulf Coast residents would have to pay back funds but Iraqis would not, he blinked 23 times and hitched his trousers up by the belt. Sure, he's nervous.
Well, when you're dealing with people that can't move their muscles and you say, blink once for yes, blink twice for no, maybe, just maybe, there's something inside of Junior that's trying to get out. They're trying to tell the truth.
It
can't.
Yeah.
So you just blinks and hitches and foot jiggles to try to say, hey, I'm in here, I'm alive, and I know this is all a bunch of crap, but...
Yeah,
this is my theory.
It could be, Scott. I suspect, frankly, that your theory is wrong. I think that that's what he does when he's lying. But actually, I think everybody, when they lie, feels uncomfortable. So, you know, I guess in that sense, you're right. Jim in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania on the line. Hey, Jim, welcome
Tom,
to the program.
How you doing? You forgot to mention that Frist voted on hospital bills while we had those talks, too.
Oh, constantly. He led some of the legislation.
What I want to talk to you about is last night on the news, they showed Bush, you know, he's going to get the hammer out and help them down there build homes.
Yeah, right.
And it showed a yellow school bus unloading Mexican illegal aliens in this country that they're going to use for the labor force.
That's right. That's right.
And Viola Burton is going to pay him $5 an hour.
That's
now,
right.
If this wasn't orchestrated, what the heck was? Didn't the Bush administration waive the prevailing wage scale?
They did. They got rid of Davis-Bacon, and now they've hired contractors like Halliburton's division, you know, divisions of Halliburton, who are bringing in undocumented workers, I think is the phrase, into New Orleans to do the work. Well, they can't hire the local people. After all, they'd have to pay them a decent wage. Can't have that. That would harm corporate profits, and that's what this administration's all about. It's corporate profits. So you finally get it. It's 57 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman, helping you win the water cooler wars.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Yes, every time Rush Limbaugh hears that theme music, he ups his meds. Welcome back to our program. Alec Dubrow is with us. Alec is the media coordinator for the International Labor Communications Association, ILCA, a group, loosely affiliated with the AFL-CIO, Alec?
Tightly affiliated.
Tightly.
We're an affiliated institute
okay.
of the Federation.
And the website is ilcaonline.org. And I wanted to talk with you, Alec, about a campaign against Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola is iconic in the United States. A lot of, you know, I lived in Atlanta for a decade and a half, and you walk into a restaurant in Atlanta and order a Pepsi, and they'll run you out with a rake, you know, come after you with a stick. And yet Coke is now the, you know, finding itself at odds with organized labor. What's going on?
Well, Coke, first of all, the issue isn't just the United States. The Coke is iconic throughout the world. I heard this quote saying that it's the second word that lots of babies around the world learn after mama is Coca-Cola. I don't know whether that was put out by the Coke people or the people who don't like Coke, but in any case, what's happened is that Coke is on the receiving end, a well-deserved receiving end, for its actions and inactions in Colombia. And specifically at its unionized bottling plants throughout Colombia.
Colombia, the country of Colombia.
Colombia, the country, not the university, not the district of, but the country. And you got to put it in, I'll quickly put it in a context. Since 1986, 4,000 trade unionists have been killed in Colombia, most of them by right-wing paramilitaries, often in direct collusion with government officials and with company management. And that is, in fact, the case is what happened here.
Now, that's a strong charge to make, that a company would be... I mean, we saw this in the United States in the 1800s when Pinkerton and other companies would be hired to bust strikes and break up and intimidate strikers. And in some cases, the companies, of course, saying, well, we didn't know they were going to do it. And companies like Pinkerton, not specifically to pick on Pinkerton, but, you know, because there was shortage of people doing this. But, you know, people ended up dead. And a lot of people ended up dead. To say that Coca-Cola is actually involved in the death of these folks in Colombia, is there evidence of that?
Yes, there is, as a matter of fact. And it's, of course, at times a tenuous and difficult connection, but it's been made pretty succinctly in a lawsuit that is still outstanding in federal court under the Alien Tort Act.
Which allows American companies to be sued in the United States for activities that they engage in, torts, violations of the law, harms that they cause other persons outside the United States.
Right.
Yeah.
Since 1989, 8 union leaders from Coca-Cola plants have been murdered by paramilitary forces, and dozens of others have been tortured, beaten, and many of them simply run off. And the evidence is quite clear here. An NPR reporter wrote in 2002, paramilitary leaders told me on several occasions they protect business interests in Colombia, and they've established bases near Coca-Cola bottling facilities. There are plenty of documented conversations between Coke managers in those places and the paramilitaries to get rid of the unions, whatever you do. And in their case, as you pointed out, it's kind of something that more or less has passed from the scene in the United States. I guess we should be grateful all we have is union-busting lawyers and Vance security guards. The fact is, this is torture and selective murder. And as a result, a number of organizations, some labor-connected, some student organizations, have taken it upon themselves to bring Coke to justice for this.
Now, this is a corporation that made $4 billion in profit last year, paid
right.
its CEO over $100 million. They can't afford to pay union wages in a country like Colombia, where a union wage would probably be, what, $3, $4 an hour instead of the, you know, $2 an hour?
That's exactly right. You've got your numbers pretty close to what I understand it to be. Yes, what they've done is, in fact, what many American corporations have done is they simply dismissed them as workers when they couldn't bust the union and rehired them as independent contractors. Now that like 70% of their workers, you know, are day laborers, they might as well just pick them up out of a lot and bring them there. But yes, they want to pay them, you know, $2 an hour, $1 an hour, as low as they can possibly drive it.
So what's the response to this? I know that there's a lawsuit, this lawsuit that's slowly grinding its way through federal court.
Yeah.
At the same time that there are actually Republican efforts to do away with the Alien Tort Act, the Alien Tort Claims Act. I'm sure you're familiar with that.
I am. And it's interesting that at the moment the suit just... it's asleep because the judge on this recent Bush appointee apparently just can't stir himself to do anything about it.
Right.
This is in the South Florida district. But in any case...
So what's being done besides the lawsuit?
Well, you know, you take it to the court of public opinion. And this October 24th, it's a consolidation of student movements in the U.S., Canada, and the U.K. called Week of Action Against Coke and for Human Rights. And they're bringing union leaders. The union's called Sinaltrenol or Sinatrenol. I'm not quite sure of the pronunciation. But their president will be talking before audiences throughout this country and Canada. And they are trying to do what Students Against Sweatshops has done and get Coke off the campus, essentially persuade university officials and others not to sell it. I mean, Coke has a sensitive point, and they are liable to a boycott of this sort.
But is Pepsi any better? I mean, when Nixon opened China, he did it basically on behalf of Pepsi. They've been using slave labor in China for what, 4 decades now?
Indeed. I'm not sure that anything.
Or is it you just fight your battles where you fight them because it generates news, it puts the thing out there, and you know you do the best you can. You can't put out every fire all at once.
No, you can't put out every fire, and frankly there are some differences between fighting over wages and getting murdered. And this is, it doesn't get any worse than this. And Koch has maintained that they have no responsibility for it. But the truth is that the bottling companies are theoretically independent, but they're staffed with Koch people, and Koch only buys up to 49% of it, so that they say they have no legal liability to it. But in fact, they are Koch entities. So yes, you put pressure on Koch where you can. One of the plaintiffs in the lawsuit is the International Labor Rights Fund, who I talked about, but also the United Steelworkers, which are trying to bring it to their membership, every unorganized worker is a threat to every organized worker. That doesn't mean you go shoot the unorganized workers. That means you organize them. And in this case, yes. I mean, it's the same company. You have to have cross-border organizing. Our workers here at Coca-Cola will undergo the same sort of thing, maybe minus the assassinations, as soon as Coke can do it. So you take a stand, and you take a moral stand, and with some hope, you get the public involved, because I don't see how they could not be in this case.
Well, when you and I were kids, Alec, most cities had a newspaper, had a conservative newspaper that had the business section in it, and had a progressive or liberal or democratic newspaper that had the labor section in it. And the labor news was out there, and every day people could read labor news, what was going on with labor all around the country, all around the world. Today, that's all gone. There's no labor news on the National Network News. There's no labor news on CNN. There's no labor news, obviously, on Fox News. There's no labor news in newspapers. It's all business news, and it's all corporate news. And so, we try and get you on every week to talk about the labor news. But in absent of labor news, the fact that nobody discusses labor in the United States anymore because the media is all corporate controlled. Mm. And how are these students going to get the word out about this activity the week of October 23rd, you said? How are they going to get the word out?
24th.
Is there a website for it?
I suggest that listeners go to studentsagainstsweatshops.org. There's all their materials there, and even a handbook on how to do it. How are they going to do it? The way you normally do it, with civil demonstrations, and just attempting, even if you can't get it in the media, on one-to-one on people. It has had an effect around the country. A number of colleges have banned Coke, and I'm sure they don't like this. I don't think they like being, pointed out this way.
This is great. It's a movement that it would be interesting to see move into our high schools as well, because that's the incubator for the
right.
next generation of activists.
It is, and it's Coke's incubator for bad teeth around the world, is to try to get people on it as soon as possible. But, I'm not even against soft drinks. In this case, there's hundreds of soft drinks. You don't have to drink Coca-Cola.
Yeah.
Send them a message.
Okay. Well said. Alec Dubrow, the media coordinator for the International Labor Communications Association, ilcaonline.org, the website. Alec, thanks for being with us.
Talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
Indeed. Do good. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, Truth and Common Sense in Broadcasting, for a change.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
When I was feeling sad and kind of blue, I didn't know what I was gonna do. The communists were coming around, they were in the air, they were on the ground, they were all over.
Uh-oh. Better look out, them communists. Maybe even them Democrats.
So I ran down most hurriedly and joined the John Birch Society. I got me a secret membership card, went back to my backyard, and started looking on the sidewalk, beneath a rose bush.
Ah, yes, you'll find them everywhere if you start looking for them. Damn communists! You know, it used to be them communists, now it's them terrorists. It's they're just all over the places. We're speaking with James Yee in the first hour of this program. The tragedy of McCarthyism rising its ugly head. But, you know, it's not all bad news. In fact, we have a jolly good fellow alert for the day. REI. Have you ever heard of this company? REI. It's called Recreational Equipment Incorporated. And this is an article from the Seattle Post-Intelligencer Reporter. The upcoming holidays are about to get a whole lot merrier for Recreational Equipment Inc.'s part-time and seasonal workers. REI is going to extend medical benefits to all of its employees, regardless of the number of hours per week that they work. It puts them in a league all their own. As REI spokesman Randy Herlow said, we've long been a leader in giving benefits to employees with 20-plus hours per week. Now we're extending medical benefits to all employees, including part-time, even seasonal, if they have worked with us for 30 days. So REI has been recognized as one of the 100 best companies to work for by Fortune magazine. And it's just, you know, it's really remarkable. You treat your people well, you treat them as assets, and companies actually do well from this. I tell you, having run a number of companies myself, when you look at companies that think of employees, that think of human beings as an expense or commodity, you know that over the long term, you're seeing a company that's not going to have necessarily the very best future. Or if they do, it's going to be at a terrible price to society. Whereas if you treat your people well and you pay them well and you bring them into the company and you allow them to participate in the profits of the company, then you get people who are there forever. Louise and I started a business back in 1983 in Atlanta, Georgia. And I know there are at least two people still working there who were working there when we started that company. I mean, I don't need to regale you with the stories, and it didn't mean to be, you know, blowing my horn, but it's just so real. It's so very much there. Greg Gorman is with us. Hey, Greg, Talk Radio News Service. What's up?
Well, Tom, I've literally come in out of the rain in New York City, where I still am, from our domestic violence radio row yesterday. It is pouring rain here in the Northeast, and I have made a pit stop to call you. Because we want to talk about James Dobson. Of course, you and I spoke a little earlier today about James Dobson, who, of course, is supporting Harriet Myers as the next associate justice on the Supreme Court. He is now backpedaling and saying that he does not have any inside information from the White House, wink, wink, that she will be a good, hard, right-wing conservative on the bench.
Yeah, see, what he's trying to say. Right. What he's trying to say is that he did not participate in this conference call.
That's right. And he's trying to now backpedal and say that he never said that he did. And
go ahead, Greg.
And all these issues. And so now, I think that we'll really watch James Dobson to see what he said, what he didn't say, and what he's trying to say now.
I think it's amazing that a fringe cult leader, basically. I mean, I call myself a Christian, and James Dobson does not represent me. He is a cult leader. He is the leader of a small group within a very large religion that has many denominations and many facets, and yet the guy has national prominence, and I don't understand why.
That's actually what I was just about to say, Tom, and I'm glad to hear you say that, because I don't want to feel like I'm out on a limb here. I mean, James Dobson, if you go to him or the people that support him, say that he has a huge platform and huge pull, and strangely enough, he does, and he has national prominence, and people in the White House, including Karl Rove, go to him on issues very often. And yet, I feel like you, in that he doesn't speak for me. He doesn't speak for a lot of the people that I know, and I'm not sure how he got to the point where he is being asked to participate in conference calls, and whether he's being asked to be someone who is going to help input what the administration's doing. It's a mystery to me.
Yeah, this is amazing. The conference call, by the way, that we're talking about, for those listeners who might not have heard it yesterday when I played it, here's just a very short clip from it. This is Richard Land, an RNC conference call.
He and she both understand that if she were to get on the court and she were to rule in ways that are contrary to the way the president would want her to approach her role as a justice, it would be a deep personal betrayal and would be perceived as such both by him and by her.
Both by George Bush and by Harriet Myers. In other words, she's his sock puppet. She's going to do whatever he says, and she's going to do it, you know, for at least 20 years. And that was Richard Land. But at that, probably the conference call that James Dobson was on. And I'm just amazed, if I've got the thing, why doesn't the media have this? Why aren't they playing this? So it's amazing.
You know, and that's a great question to ask. Let's keep asking that same question.
There you go. And thanks a lot, Greg. Greg Gorman with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Good to have you on. It is 27 minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman Radio Program. The place where we're tuning in is as easy as getting a press pass to the White House if you're a gay hooker.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. You're in the no boring zone. Photo op bites back. You see this in the Washington Post today, Dan Frumkin's piece? He's talking about this photo op that George W. had down in New Orleans and area. And Matt Lauer, the news... Well, I'm not going to slam Matt. Matt's, you know, he's just a guy trying to make a living, right? He happens to be in the media. He's just a guy trying to make a living. Anyhow, so he asks George W. Bush. He says, I talked to a prominent Democrat in Louisiana who said that this kind of appearance, well, it's great to see you guys rolling up your sleeves and grabbing a hammer and helping build this piece of wall here, that it's really a photo op, and they want to see a plan on paper, your plan to rebuild this region. Do you have that kind of plan? And Bush says, basically, no. In fact, he says the point is that it comes from the local folks. And I recognize there's an attitude in Washington that says we know better than the local people. That's just not the attitude I have. In other words, Bush has no plan. So then Lauer says, he starts quoting another Democrat, and Bush interrupts him and says, only half-jokingly, says Dan Frumkin, you're quoting a lot of Democrats today, Matt. That's interesting. And then he goes on to say, I think our job is to elevate this whole process out of normal politics. So then Lauer says, is that really possible? And Bush shoots back, it depends on who asked the questions, I guess. George Bush putting Matt Lauer on notice that if he continues to ask tough questions of George Bush, he's going to lose his job because George Bush won't answer his questions anymore. And if George Bush won't answer a reporter's questions, the network fires that reporter. It's just that simple. At the same time, the Washington Post Dana Milbank's piece, President Bush is already facing his second question of the day about Karl Rove's legal problems. Does it worry you, said NBC's Matt Lauer, that prosecutors seem to have such an interest in Mr. Rove? Bush blinks twice. He touches his tongue to his lips. He blinks twice more. He starts to answer, but he stops himself. I'm not going to talk about the case, Bush finally says after a three-second pause that in television times feels like a commercial break. It's interesting. Dana Milbank, he says, this much could be seen watching the tape of NBC's broadcast during Bush's 14-minute pre-sunrise interview in which he stood unprotected by the usual lectern. The president was a blur of blinks, taps, jiggles, pivots, and shifts. So standing with Lauer and the serene, steady First Lady, he had the body language of a man wishing urgently to be elsewhere. The fidgeting clearly corresponded to the questioning. When Lauer asked if Bush, after a slow response to Katrina, was, quote, trying to get a second chance to make a good first impression, end quote, Bush blinked 24 times in his answer. When asked why Gulf Coast residents would have to pay back funds, but Iraqis would not, Bush blinked 23 times and hitched up his trousers by the belt. When the questioning turned to Harriet Myers, Bush blinked 37 times in a single answer, along with a lick of the lips, three weight shifts, and some serious foot jiggling. Yeah, he seemed to lose control of his timing. As Lauer went on through his introduction, the presidential eyes zoomed left, then right, then right, then left, then left again, then center, then up and down at the interviewer. Presidential fidgeting spiked when Lauer mentioned the Democratic accusation that Bush was performing a photo op. Bush pushed out his lower front lip, then licked the right corner of his mouth. Lauer's query about whether conservatives are feeling let down by you appeared to provoke a furious jiggling of the right leg. Amazing. So, guess what? The media is starting to notice. Now, whether Bush can get this under control or not, time will tell. My guess is he will. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-THOM, as in Tom, T-H-O-M, 1-866-440-THOM. Rick in Grand Rapids, Michigan on the line. Hey, Rick, what's up?
Well, Tom, I've been following the legal travails of the prominent Republicans, and I'm just wondering what you think about how they might deal with this. I see that Tom DeLay has now subpoenaed the prosecutor that indicted him. Now, I didn't know they could do that. I wish Bill Clinton had done that with Ken Starr, because obviously Ken Starr was a partisan Republican. He probably manipulated some of those grand juries, but I guess the Democrats just weren't ruthless enough. And now
that's the bottom line, really, Rick, and that's what it's all about, is Tom DeLay plays to win. It doesn't matter what's right or wrong. What matters to Tom DeLay is whether or not Tom DeLay wins.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, right now, the fact of the matter is he's fighting for his own survival.
Sure.
And so I don't think either one of us could blame him for using any legal tools at his disposal to try and keep out of jail. I mean, that's
right.
Just that's a human instinct.
Right.
But the fact of the matter is that this comes on the back end of a multi-decade career of breaking the rules, bending the rules, holding votes open after Democrats win votes so that they can twist arms and have Republicans win votes. I mean, this guy is about as amoral as it gets when it comes to these sorts of issues. So, you know, it shouldn't surprise us that he would do this.
Now, on the other hand, with this Fitzgerald prosecutor, who is not really, to my estimation, a Democrat at all. In fact, I heard he was apolitical, and he was, in fact, appointed by George Bush. And I heard Matt Drudge say, you know, it's going to be a lot harder to paint him as some kind of a partisan guy out on a vendetta. But yet, last night, you know, and you'll forgive me if I mention these other talk show hosts, but I just want to see what they're saying. You know, there's the old saying, know thy enemy. And Sean Hannity is just painting this whole thing as, well, you know, you Democrats, this is all you have. You smear people and blah, blah, blah. And I'm thinking, well, this is an investigation by a prosecutor who was appointed by the president.
Right, by the Republicans.
What do the Democrats have to, in fact, the Democrats, even in the Harriet Meyer situation, they're not saying much.
Democrats have nothing to do with it. They're sitting back and shutting up and watching the Republicans implode. Now, I mean, Hannity is so bad that he's comical.
He's actually worse than Limbaugh, I think. He's almost childish.
Well, and he gets it. You know, Limbaugh, at least, you know, to talk about the other side for a moment, Limbaugh, for at least the first 7, 8, 9 years of his show, had a coherent worldview. It's one that I strongly disagree with. You know, the conservative worldview that aristocracy, corporate power, inherited wealth, that's what it's all about, and that you use wedge issues, you use social issues to bring along the average person to vote against their own economic self-interest.
Sure.
At least Limbaugh was consistent, and he would attack both Republicans and Democrats. And then, you know, I don't know, I guess it was around 4 or 5 years ago, something like that, about the time that I think he sold his show, and I really don't know the inside politics of this. This is not an inside baseball discussion, but 4 or 5 years ago, all of a sudden, he just started becoming a partisan. Hannity has always been a partisan. If the Republicans do it, it's right. If the Democrats do it, it's wrong. I mean, Limbaugh at least used to say, when the Republicans would favor, for example, big deficits, he'd say that's wrong. Now he says it's right. So, you know, they've both, you know, their credibility is just in the toilet, and it's tragic. And truth be told, there are a few people on the left as well who are just whose loyalty is partisan rather than to principle. And I'm just, you know, I'm not going to go beyond that. And I'm certainly, you know, hopefully my loyalty is to my principles. And that's what I try to hold it to. Rick, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. I don't know how I got wandered off on that. Ken in Long Beach, California. Hey, Ken, how are you doing today? What's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom? Yeah, I'm a very disillusioned Republican myself. I'm one of those people that's been brought along by the wedge issues. But in the past, since I started listening to you, but anyway, you were talking to a guy named Dell, I think, the other day. You're having like a debate with him. I guess he was a guest or something on your show, right?
I'm not sure. I don't recall.
I think it was a couple of weeks ago. But he was saying that the per capita income has increased in this country. And I was just thinking that, yeah, maybe it has increased, probably because the top richest people have increased so much in wealth that, you know, the average. You know, if Bill Gates were to move in on your block, you only had 5 people on your block, you know, per capita.
On average, all of you are billionaires, yeah. No, actually, it's interesting, yeah, because a couple of weeks ago, the Republicans were running around saying, isn't it great, everybody in America is richer. And then the Internal Revenue Service actually issued the report last Thursday. In fact, Bernie Sanders talked about it on Friday in this program. And it showed that for 99% 99% of Americans, 99% of Americans, there was actually a decrease in overall income since George Bush became president, after, you know, steady but slow increases, essentially since World War II. And
yeah,
for the top 1%, for the top 1%, there was a substantial increase. And for the top 0.1%, that is people earning more than $13 million a year, there was an explosion in wealth. And such an explosion in wealth for that top 0.1% that the entire, that if you look at the entire country, it looked like everybody got richer. So Ken, that's...
We have almost 1,000 billionaires now. And I remember when I was a kid, there was only Howard Hughes, Rockefeller. You could count them on one hand.
Oh, yeah.
Billionaires.
Yeah, and part of that
is... It was more of a middle class.
Yeah, part of that is inflation, but a lot of it is that, the cons like to say it's not a zero-sum game. In other words, it doesn't matter if somebody's a billionaire. It's not going to take out of somebody else's pocket. But the reality is that at a certain level, it is, to a certain extent, a zero-sum game. And the more billionaires you have, the less of a middle class you can have. And, you know, tragically, it's just the way it works. Ken, I appreciate the call. Great to hear from you. Thank you very much. It is Bernard in Sacramento, California. Hey, Bernard, what's on your mind today?
Oh, great to talk to you, Tom.
Well, thank you for calling, and thanks for listening to 1240 Talk City there in Sacramento.
Yes, here's my idea. I guess it's a little bit idealistic or something, and it's been around a while, but it never happens. It's public funding of campaigns, because I'm a Democrat, but heck, the Democrats are almost as prostituted as the Republicans. I mean,
certainly the DLC Democrats are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so no matter who wins, and I hope to God we could get the Republicans out of there, out of total control, but then there's still special interest running the country.
Sure. The two big barriers to that, Bernard, and you raise a really good point, and it's being done right now, by the way, in Maine and Arizona with some success, but the two big barriers are, number one, that the Supreme Court has said, number one, that if you start restraining the ability of wealthy individuals to give money, you're limiting their freedom of speech under the First Amendment. And there may be some legitimacy to that argument. And secondly, and this is an illegitimate argument in my opinion, the Supreme Court has said that corporations are persons and therefore they have a right to give to politics too. Since they don't have a mouth, they speak with money. I think it's wrong. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Looking down the nose is what people say. These is words and words okay. It's what you do.
And welcome back, my friends. The minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. It's the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. Tom Hartman Radio Program, 49 minutes past the hour. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-THOM, 440-TOM, T-H-O-M, and is that Primo in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania? Am I reading that right?
That's right, Tom.
Hey, Primo, what's up?
Hey, I just want to say you got a great show.
Well, and thank you for listening to us on WPTT there in Pittsburgh.
I have two questions, and I'll hang up to listen. One, what does Halliburton actually do, and are there any other companies in the United States that do something similar to them?
Yeah, number one, Halliburton has a lot of competitors. There's a fascinating book about the history of Halliburton that I read about, I don't know, 3 or 4 months ago. We had the guy on who wrote it as a guest on the program. Started out as there was this guy named Mr. Halliburton from Texas who was a wildcatter, you know, who was drilling for oil, and he figured out a way, a better way to drill for oil, basically. And Halliburton has developed a couple of technologies to extract oil more efficiently with less waste and side diagonal drilling and some kind of an injection drilling where they blow steam in and they've got a lot of cool things that they do. Most of the contracts that, for example, the reconstruction of Iraq and what's going on with Iraq are not actually Halliburton contracts. Halliburton has done what Enron did, and that is they have spun off companies or they've acquired companies. They shut them down as U.S. companies. They reincorporate them in the Bahamas or the Cayman Islands in tax havens so that they're no longer U.S. companies, so they no longer have to pay U.S. income taxes. And then those companies are the companies that are getting the government contracts. So the major one for Iraq, for example, is Kellogg Brown & Root, KBR. And KBR is not an American company. It's owned by Halliburton, but it's incorporated, I believe, in the Cayman Islands. It might be Bermuda. And, in fact, the reason that John Kerry voted for the $87 billion before he voted against it was because the original $87 billion in aid to the troops and rebuilding of Iraq that went through Congress back in 2004, that original bill had a rider in it that said that the Democrats had put there that said that any tax dollars that were used for the rebuilding of Iraq could only go to U.S. chartered corporations. In other words, corporations that if they made a profit, they would pay U.S. income taxes on it. And the Republicans defeated that. The Republicans shot that down. John Kerry voted for the $87 billion, along with a whole lot of Democrats. The Republicans shot it down. The Republicans reinvented the bill, another $87 billion, only this time it didn't say that you had to be a U.S. corporation, and that's the one that John Kerry voted against. And, you know, I'm just amazed that the Republicans could turn that into a soundbite that hurt him in the election, and that the Democrats didn't come back and say, "Hey, we were trying to stop traitorous corporations from walking away with our tax dollars."
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think the Democrats really rolled up their sleeves and did too much fighting.
No, they didn't. There's a guy named Bob Schrum who's been running Democratic campaigns ever since Michael Dukakis, and he keeps running them into the ground. And his philosophy seems to be when somebody, you know, kicks at you, you back up, roll up in a ball and roll away. I mean, they thought that the Swift Boat thing was going to blow over. Michael Dukakis thought the Willie Horton ads were going to become, you know, everybody's going to laugh at them. And Bob Schrum was running one of that one too. And I just, you know, I hope they keep this guy away from future candidates because it's just absolutely a disaster. Primo, thanks a lot for calling. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Davis in Eureka, California, listening on KGOE. Hey, Davis, what's up?
Tom,
or Dave.
Yes,
yeah.
Can you hear me?
I can.
Okay. Your theory on what may have been behind Bill Frist's plight there, I think is probably right on. One logic that I haven't heard mentioned, but had Frist not sold all his stocks.
Let me just interrupt you for a second, Dave. For those people who haven't been listening as long as you have today, my theory about Bill Frist in a nutshell is, my guess is that Bill Frist really didn't do an insider trading thing and dump his stock to make an extra couple $100,000. The guy's a multi-millionaire. His father's a billionaire. My theory is that he dumped that stock because the Republicans, to punish him for going out in favor of stem cells, that George Bush was punishing him by leaking to the media the fact that HCA, the company that he owned all his stock in, was one of the largest abortion providers in the United States. And so he was trying to get rid of the stock in a hurry. And now Bush is using that to prosecute him with the SEC. I think Bill Frist is being punished.
And that would be totally consistent with the whole Rove Cheney thing there. But
oh, yeah, it's a punishment machine. They reward their friends regardless of their competence or incompetence, and they mercilessly and relentlessly punish their enemies.
Well, the point that I would like you to consider is that had somebody as big and as well-connected and as big an owner in the corporation, when someone like that sells out all of a sudden, that just says something to the rest of the owners. It says, Frist knows something that we don't know. That's why the stocks dropped off. Had he stayed on, it never would have happened.
No, actually, the stock dropped off because it was a week later. The stock dropped. First of all, he didn't own that much stock in the corporation. He was very much a minority stockholder.
Oh.
But secondly, the stock dropped because the company announced that they had poor earnings in the previous quarter. And his brother and his father would have known that because they were inside the company. And the question that the SEC is looking into is, did Bill Frist know that a week later the company was going to make an announcement that was going to cause its stock to drop because they had poor earnings? If he knew that, then he did engage in insider trading and he committed a crime. If he didn't know that, then he didn't. And my guess is it's going to, you know, that this investigation into whether or not he committed a crime is going to go nowhere. This is about political assassination, not about criminal activity.
Such despicable
I hate
character.
To defend Bill Frist, but that's my take on it, you know.
No, there's such despicable character on both sides of it. All
yeah.
sides of it. The neocons are not much on ethics.
Yeah, yeah, and so we'll just have to watch it and see how it plays out. Dave, thanks a lot for the call. Kevin in Washington, D.C. on the line. Hey, Kevin, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, I just want to point out, you know, what's going on in Colombia where they're killing strikers, Coca-Cola?
Yes.
That goes on here in the United States. Case in point, the coal mining wars in West Virginia and Kentucky.
Yeah, that have been going on for a century.
Yeah, and they kill people in those states, striking workers, you know, and it's going on as we speak right now. So,
yeah.
You know, this is nothing strange or exotic or happening. It's happening in our doorstep.
Yeah, and it needs to, and Kevin, I don't know of any specific examples of that. Do you in the very near recent past?
Well, there was a documentary made about 10 years ago about a mining company in West Virginia
right.
where they assassinated the ringleader of the strikes.
Yeah, it was alleged that they did. I don't think that there was a conviction in that case. I recall that, but the fact is that intimidation of workers in the United States, and who knows? I mean, the Karen Silkwood thing, that had nothing to do with labor, but you know, just that sort of thing. People die, people vanish. You just never know. People get accused of crimes that they had nothing to do with as ways of, you know, shutting them up politically. Just all sorts of strange things happen, and there's a very real war against organized labor going on here in the United States, just like there is in Colombia. Kevin, thank you for calling and pointing that out. Well said, and we'll ask Alec about that next time we talk to him, because he's usually on top of that kind of stuff. A remarkable day. A lot of news. The president is Blue Ribbon Commission now saying, maybe we shouldn't allow people to deduct their home interest mortgages so that we can have more tax cuts for billionaires and millionaires. Maybe we shouldn't let small companies deduct the money that they pay for health care for their employees. More tax cuts for billionaires and millionaires. Go figure.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, it's all about her religion. Yes, that's what George W. Bush says about Harriet Myers. It's all about her religion. People are interested to know why I picked Harriet Myers, Bush told reporters at the White House today. He said they want to know Harriet Myers' background. They want to know as much as they can possibly know before they form opinions. And part of Harriet Myers' life is her religion. This from George W. Bush. James Dobson saying that Karl Rove has assured him, quote, she is from a very conservative church, which is almost universally pro-life. Is it all about abortion? Is it really all about a religion? Well, I got to say, it's really not about religion. It's about power. A power, ultimately, that wants to replace democracy. This is just so incredible. For example, Judge Moore, the Ten Commandments judge, he's going to run for governor of Alabama most likely next year. And he's running around saying that he should be able to keep a graven image of the Ten Commandments in the Alabama Supreme Court rotunda because he says America is a Judeo-Christian nation founded by Christians, and the foundation of American law is the Bible and Ten Commandments. Well, let's see what the founders and framers, those people who signed the Declaration of Independence, the framers, the people who wrote and signed the Constitution, had to say about that. It's very clear to me that they believe that a secular democracy was the most powerful unifying force for a decent and peaceful civil society. Now, by secular, I don't mean anti-religious. Many, in fact, probably most of the founders, including Thomas Jefferson, who considered himself a deist, who would not call himself a Christian, George Washington, who would not call himself a Christian, were deeply spiritual men. As Ben Franklin talked about, who said, you know, early on, I absented myself from Christian assemblies. Their dogma made no sense to me. Ben Franklin talked about the mystery, the great mystery. He was very fond of the Native American phrase for the Creator, it's a Wakantanka, which literally translates into the great mystery, the great mysterious. But they also understood that when it comes to politics, when it comes to running a country, that you don't do that based on religion. You do that based on politics. And politics is what secular means. Secular does not mean anti-religious. It doesn't mean no religion. What it means is it's about governance. The founders figured out, you know, they knew that there were four categories of power: military, religious, corporate or wealth, and political. And the interaction of these kinds of power have produced three historic kinds of tyranny. Jefferson wrote about the warlord kings, theocratic popes, and wealthy feudal lords or monopolistic corporations like the East India Company, for example, that this country rose up against in 1773, in the winter of 1773 at the Boston Tea Party. Our founders had figured out that every single time in the history of civilization, you look back over the 7,000-year history of civilization, back to the rise of Gilgamesh and Uruk in what is now, ironically enough, Iraq. And it was always one of these three forms of government, these three forms of tyranny, either warlord kings, theocrats, people who claimed their power came from God, or people who ruled by virtue of their wealth, feudal lords or monopolistic corporations. And they said, we don't want any of those three. We're going to have political power of, by, and for we the people. That's a secular government, we the people. Not of, by, and for the corporations or the rich, not of, by, and for warlord kings, not of, by, and for religious or churches or the Catholic Church, Protestant Church, any kind of, by we the people. Very straightforward. For example, to keep political power from combining with military power in the United States of America, this is to stop warlord kings, the army was put under civilian control, the elected president. And he, in turn, was told that he was legally incapable of declaring war. That power is solely given to Congress. So two barriers to warlord kings ruling the United States. As James Madison said on April 20th in 1795, he was talking about how presidents would always be tempted to gain excessive power by becoming warlords, which is why Congress has to withhold from the president the power to make war. He said, and I quote, April 20, 1795, James Madison, who would 6 years later be president of the United States. This was after he helped write the Constitution. He said, in war, the discretionary power of the president is extended. Its influence in dealing out offices, honors, and emoluments is multiplied. And all the means of seducing the minds are added to those of subduing the force of the people. The same malignant aspect in republicanism may be traced in the inequality of fortunes and the opportunities of fraud growing out of a state of war, and in the degeneracy of manners and morals engendered by both. No nation, wrote James Madison on April 20, 1795, no nation can preserve its freedom in the midst of continual warfare. No nation. The founders also felt that we should not have political power combined with the power of great economic power, of great wealth. That should be banned. It's one of the reasons why Thomas Jefferson, in a December 26, 1825 letter to William Giles, talked about banning monopolies in commerce, stopping corporations from getting as large as the East India Company that they'd overthrown. In this letter, the day after Christmas, 1825, to William Giles, Thomas Jefferson wrote, economic powers will always seek to gain political power and thus threaten to create a single and splendid government of an aristocracy founded on banking institutions and moneyed in corporations under the guise and cloak of their favored branches of manufactures, commerce, and navigation, riding and ruling over the plundered plowmen and beggared yeomanry. The plowman is the farmers and the yeoman is the people who work in factories, the working class. Isn't that incredible? Economic power will always seek to gain political power and thus threaten to create a single and splendid government of an aristocracy founded on banking institutions and moneyed in corporations under the guise and cloak of their favored branches of manufacture, commerce, and navigation, riding and ruling over the plundered plowmen and beggared yeomanry. Thomas Jefferson, December 26, 1825. 18 years after he left being president of the United States. But most important, with the memory of the Salem witch trials fresh in their minds, the founders knew that among all the dangers that represented this country, organized religion might be the most dangerous. They were well-schooled in the history of the Crusades. They knew from firsthand experience how oppressive religious men could be with even small amounts of power. In Ben Franklin's, he wrote a short booklet. It was an autobiographical booklet. It was called From the Mystery. or toward the mystery, excuse me. And it was about his spiritual perspective. And he said, and I quote, quoting Ben Franklin, "I have found Christian dogma unintelligible. Early in life, I absented myself from Christian assemblies." And yet Franklin was a very spiritual guy. He was a deist, a philosophy made popular by early Unitarians. And their philosophy basically was that the Creator made the universe long ago and doesn't interfere. Another founding deist, George Washington. Thomas Jefferson, in his personal diary entry for February 1, 1799. I remember when I first read this, I was reading Jefferson's diaries. I'm not sure that anybody had ever quoted this before, but it's there. You can find it. Thomas Jefferson's personal diary, February 1, 1799. Quote, "When the clergy addressed General Washington on his departure from the government, it was observed in their consultation that he had never, on any occasion, said a word to the public which showed a belief in the Christian religion, and they thought that they should so pen their address," this is their letter to him, their request, "as to force him at length to publicly declare whether or not he was a Christian. However," Jefferson wrote in his diary, "the old fox was too cunning for them. He answered every article of their address, their letter, their questions, particularly except that," whether or not he was a Christian, "which he passed over without notice." Washington never did, I'm quoting Thomas Jefferson, "Washington never did say a word on the subject in any of his public papers except in his valedictory letter to the governors of the states when he resigned his commission in the army, wherein he speaks of the benign influence of the Christian religion. I know," wrote Thomas Jefferson, "that Governor Morris, who pretends to be in his secrets, in Washington's confidence, and believes himself to be so, has told me that General Washington believes no more in that fundamentalist Christian system than he himself did." End of quote. So here we have the founders of this country saying, you know, religion is great as long as it stays out of government. And now we have the President of the United States saying that he's appointing somebody to the Supreme Court because of her religion. How far have we come? I'll share a little more with you on that in just a moment. It's 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. You're in the Democracy Zone.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And a good old USA.
In the good old USA, I'm proud to say, we got brand new action, good old fashioned too.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here, the program, our program, the pill that will help you escape the matrix. Yes, just take the pill. Yes. And in fact, George Washington, I just want to get back to this thing. The separation of church and state is a really important topic. It is a topic that the founders were obsessed with. Thomas Jefferson was convinced that religious people were trying to take over the government and that that would be the end of the United States. And he was just haunted by it. On the other hand, James Madison had no problem with that. He didn't think it would ever happen. He didn't think Americans would tolerate it. But he didn't want the government to be giving money to churches because he was afraid that it would corrupt the churches. James Madison, a good church-going man, he didn't want the money going to the churches from the government because he didn't want them corrupted. Jefferson didn't want people from churches, didn't want ministers running for political office. Not that he would thought that he could stop them or even should stop them, but he would just, you know, he was spooked by it. George Washington helped write the treaty with Tripoli that was signed into law by John Adams, the first of the first four presidents of the United States. It was Washington, Adams, Jefferson, Madison, the first four presidents. Adams was the only one who was out, essentially, about being a Christian. Washington was either an atheist or a deist. Jefferson was definitely a deist. Madison went to church, but he, in all probability, was a deist. He read his papers. But John Adams was a good church-going guy, and he signed a treaty with Tripoli that read, and I quote, "As the government of the United States of America is not in any sense founded on the Christian religion, as it has in itself no character of enmity against the laws, religion, or tranquility of the Muslim men," which is what they used to call Muslims, And as the said states never have entered into any war or active hostility against any Mohammedan nation, it is declared by the parties that no pretext arising from religious opinion shall ever produce an interruption of the harmony existing between the two countries. End of quote. The Treaty of Tripoli, 1797, put together by George Washington, signed into law by John Adams. But for the founders, this wasn't just an issue of being Christians or not. Just as they were opposed to warlords taking control of the government and thus took the ability to make war out of the hands of the president, just as they opposed economic forces from taking control of the government and thus excluded the word corporation from the Constitution so companies could be closely watched by the states and wouldn't be able to corrupt national officials, so too they opposed religious leaders from gaining any access whatsoever to the levers of political power. You think I'm exaggerating? On February 21st, 1811, James Madison vetoed a bill passed by Congress that authorized government payments to a church in Washington, D.C. to help the poor. Faith-based initiatives are a clear violation in Madison's mind of the doctrine of separation of church and state and could lead to a dangerous transfer of political power to religious leaders. In Madison's mind, caring for the poor was a public and civic duty, a function of government, and should never become a hole through which the churches could reach and grab a hold of the public purse. In fact, he said funding a church to provide for the poor would establish what he called a legal agency, what today we would call a legal precedent, that would break down that wall of separation between church and state. In his veto message to Congress, February 21st, 1811, James Madison said he was striking down the proposed law, quote, quoting now the President of the United States, James Madison, 1811, striking down this proposed law that gave money to a church in Washington, D.C. to care for the poor, quote, because the bill vests and said incorporated church and also authority to provide for the support of the poor and the education of poor children of the same would be a precedent for giving to religious societies as such a legal agency in carrying into effect a public and civic duty. In other words, you would be authorized, legally authorizing them to do something that should be done by secular government. Jefferson was probably the most outspoken of these guys, of the founders of this country. You find that quote from Jefferson that's carved onto the Jefferson Memorial in Washington, D.C. He says, I have sworn upon the altar of God eternal hostility against every form of tyranny imposed upon the mind of man. People think that means he was a big Bible thumper, right? I've sworn upon the altar of God. Here's the actual letter. It was written in 1800 to Benjamin Rush, 2 months before he got elected. Actually, we've got to take a break here. I'm going to share the letter with you after we come back because it is just so cool, and I don't want to rush through it. But this Ben Rush was a physician and a dear, close, personal friend of Thomas Jefferson's. And these guys, and Ben Rush was a deist as well. And these guys had a whole series of conversations about religion. And then later in his life, John Adams was having correspondence with Thomas Jefferson about whether Christianity or Judaism, for that matter, whether the Judeo-Christian tradition had anything at all to do with the laws of America. And I have to give you a little glimpse of that as well. I'm going to do that after the break and share with you this famous quote from Thomas Jefferson and the real context from which it came. And then we'll take your phone calls as well. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-THOM. 866-440-THOM. 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
You got to give me some shelter here. Give me some shelter from these bushies. Welcome back, my friends. 34 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The fine folks in our chat room, thank you very much. You can get to our live chat room, by the way, by going to tomhartman.com. However you spell it, will get you there. And click on the live chat link. say, the definition of secular. It's from the Middle English and the Old French word séculaire, and from the Latin secularis, meaning generation, age, century, or world. In other words, it's relating to the worldly or temporal concerns. This is from the Merriam-Webster Online Dictionary. Not overtly or specifically religious, not ecclesiastical or clerical, not bound by monastic vows or rules, occurring once in an age or a century, or existing or continuing through the ages or centuries. Secular. A secular government that was founded here. And we discover the Bush administration awarded over $2 billion in grants to religious organizations in 2004. $2 billion in grants. This is from Media Transparency, article by Bill Berkowitz on March 24, 2005. MediaTransparency.org. You can check it out. But I just want to wrap this up. Thomas Jefferson, this famous quote of his that is carved in the Jefferson Monument, that is constantly being quoted in emails to me from people who say, see, the founders were all in favor of religion. His famous quote where he said, I have sworn upon the altar of God eternal hostility against every form of tyranny over the mind of man. Well, here it is in context. In 1800, 2 months before the election of 1800, in September of 1800, he wrote, and Jefferson was running for president in this election. He wrote this to Ben Rush, his good friend, a private letter. This is, you can only find this in his personal correspondence. Dear sir, I promised you a letter on Christianity, which I have not forgotten. I do not know that it would reconcile the genus irritable vatum, which is Latin for the angry priests, who are all in arms against me. Their hostility is on too interesting a ground to be softened. And then he refers to the First Amendment of the Constitution that guarantees, it says that the Establishment Clause, it says that the government shall not establish a formal religion. He says, the delusion on the clause of the Constitution, which, while it secured the freedom of the press, covered also the freedom of religion, has given to the clergy a very favorite hope of obtaining an establishment of a particular form of Christianity throughout the United States. And as every sect believes its own, the true one, everyone perhaps hopes for his own, but especially the Episcopalians and Congregationalists. I'm still quoting from Thomas Jefferson. The returning good sense of our country threatens abortion to their hopes. And they, the preachers, believe that any portion of power confided to me, such as being elected president, will be exerted. Keep in mind, they believe that any portion of power confided to me, such as being elected president, will be exerted in opposition to their schemes. And they believe rightly, for I have sworn upon the altar of God eternal hostility against every form of tyranny over the mind of man. But this is all they have to fear from me. And enough, too, in their opinion. So the quote that everybody, see, Thomas Jefferson was a Bible thumper, was in the context of Jefferson saying he was not going to allow the churches into the government because he viewed their activity as a form of tyranny over the mind of man. And again, let me frame this by saying, I consider myself a religious and spiritual Christian. And I don't want my religion running our government. And I don't want our government giving money to my religion. Thomas Jefferson talking to John Adams a little later on. Well, actually, here's a letter to Thomas Cooper. It's a little shorter. February 10th, 1814, letter to Dr. Thomas Cooper. The question whether or not English law, on which American law was founded, was based on the Ten Commandments. He says, finally, in answer to Fortescue Allen's question, why the Ten Commandments should not now be part of the common law in England, we may say that they should not now be part of the common law because they never were. Anyone who asserts that the Ten Commandments are the basis of American or British law is mistakenly believing a document that is a manifest forgery. The reason is simple. British common law, upon which American law is based, existed before Christianity arrived in England. Sir Matthew Hale, quoting Jefferson, his letter to Cooper, February 10, 1814. Sir Matthew Hale lays it down in these words: Christianity is parcel of the laws of England. But it couldn't be. Just look at the timetable of English history. Christianity was not introduced, I'm quoting Jefferson, Christianity was not introduced till the 7th century. The conversion of the first Christian king of the Heptarchy having taken place during the year 598, and that of the last about 686. Here then was a space of 200 years during which the common law was in existence and Christianity no part of it. We might as well say that the Newtonian system of philosophy is a part of the common law as that the Christian religion is, wrote Jefferson. In truth, the alliance of between church and state in England has ever made their judges accomplices in the frauds of the clergy. And even bolder than that are they. And so, George W. Bush says Harriet Myers is his woman. He's going to put her in because of the church she attends, because of her religion. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. Vi in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Is it Vi or is it Viv?
Vi.
Vi. Hey, Vi, okay. What's up?
Well, I'm a Christian, and I do not believe George Bush is a Christian.
Okay.
I cannot go to church anywhere. I'm told I'm the devil. Now, I don't run into churches and start screaming and go up front and go nuts. If they get into a conversation about him, I bring up...
About George, you mean?
Yes.
The him,
George,
yeah.
Double,
okay.
Is wonderful. Yep. I bring up facts, and I'm very tactful. And they said that I'm a bad influence, and they as much as told me, without telling me, get out, you're the devil, we don't want you here.
Well, there's a lot of churches where you'd be welcomed by.
Where?
Well, I believe it's the United Church of Christ, I could be wrong, recently passed a resolution. They were the ones who were trying to run the ads that showed various couples, interracial couples, gay couples coming up to the church, and they said everyone's welcome here, and ABC, CBS, NBC refused to run the ads. I believe it's the United Church of Christ. I could be wrong, but I believe that's it. And of course, the Unitarians would welcome you, although they don't consider themselves Christian. And frankly, I think that there are a lot of community churches, even the Church of England. You know, it's not Presbyterians. What's the phrase? They're getting pretty liberal.
Yeah, I know what you're saying, but I'm trying to get the word out to the Christians that believe he's a Christian that he's not a Christian, starting with Carla Faye Tucker, hello.
Yeah.
What's the Bible say? To forgive and you shall be forgiven. He should have went to that family and said, yes, I'm going to leave her in prison. But
yeah.
She is bringing people to the Lord, and she's an evangelist, and she's my sister in Christ, and I'm not putting her to death.
Right.
And
well, there's these questions. You know, who would Jesus execute? Who would Jesus bomb? I mean,
yeah,
Bush thinks
yeah.
he knows the answer to these questions.
And is he still a bonesman?
Yeah. Well, I don't think that, you know, I think once you are, you always are.
Yeah, he's a bonesman and a Christian. That's a bona fide Christian.
Okay, bye. Bye. Yeah, thanks a lot for that. I appreciate it. That's a good one. Paul in Everett, Washington on the line. Hey, Paul, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks, Tom. You know, those were really great quotes from the founders, and I was just wondering, of all the underappreciated insights of the founders, which one would you select as the best if you had to vote right now?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
Well, which one of the insights of the founders is not really well known enough that would really influence people more if it was better known? Because I mean, we don't hear those particular quotes every day.
Well, it's interesting because through most of the course of the history of the United States, right up through, you know, I can speak from personal experience, right up through the 50s and 60s when I was in elementary school and high school, the notion that this was a secular country founded on the separation of church and state was being taught in schools and was undisputed. And that's a piece of history that we've lost just in the last generation or two. I think, though, that the piece of history that we've lost over the last probably three or four generations that was well known up until the 1930s, And certainly the 1940s, perhaps even the early 1950s. But I didn't learn it in school, you know, until much, much later. And they talk about it in university classes, is that the founders were opposed to the rise of corporate power as well as religious power. And that this was really a big deal for them, that in fact the United States was founded in the overthrow of corporate power, specifically the British East India Company, which had established and owned the first city in America, Jamestown, named after King James, who was the largest stockholder in the British East India Company that time, in the state of Virginia, which was named after the Virgin Queen, Queen Elizabeth I, who in December of 1600 incorporated the East India Company, and that they were administered by the East India Company, as were almost all of the states up and down the coast before we declared independence from England. And that's those two things. Those are the two realities of the founders that that oddly seem to have vanished from some of the contemporary history books written by Republican historians. People like McCullough with his book about John Adams, for example, just kind of whitewashes Adams' whole thing with the Alien and Sedition Acts, his Patriot Act stuff. I think it's tragic the way history is being rewritten these days.
Do you think Jefferson himself saw that, even in his own lifetime, that there would be this constant backsliding in terms of remembering the principles that we were founded on, and that's why
He
said we need a revolution in each generation?
Well, it could be. I think that that's why he created the University of Virginia and said that every single person in the United States, if they are capable of going to college, should be able to do so absolutely free, regardless of their station in life. That's why he started the University of Virginia, and he was spot on right about it. And we need free public education in this country. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Yeah, that's the key, my friends. We got to stick together. It's like Ben Franklin said. I mean, he spoke for all of us Americans. No matter how much George Bush wants to divide us, white from black, rich from poor, Republican from Democrat, conservative from liberal, really, we all need to pull together. We all need to be together. And we have to go back to this being one nation, where we can have rational and reasonable discussions and even arguments about issues and policies and politics without saying, oh, you're bad. This person's terrible. He's a liberal. You know what that means? Or he's a conservative. You know what that means? It just doesn't, it just doesn't make it. It does not help the dialogue. Our phone number, 1-866-440-THOM, 440-TOM. Tom Hartman program here. Speaking from behind the good old working-class stainless steel microphone of the People's Republic of Portland, Oregon. And Jerry in Sacramento, California on the line. Hey, Jerry, thanks for listening to 1240 Talk City there. What's up?
Hi, Tom. Very, very good topics. I just listened to you every day. This is great stuff.
Thank you.
I just had a quick comment or two. First one is, I remember when John Kennedy was running for president, the Republicans were up in arms because, oh, my God, he's a Roman Catholic, and the White House will be ruled from the Vatican.
That's right.
Just all over the place, and that seems to have slipped under the radar.
Oh, and he had to publicly answer it. I mean, in a news conference, he had to call a specific news conference just to deal with the Republican charges that he was going to be a papist, that he was going to be a representative of the Pope. And this was, by the way, anti-Catholic sentiment in the United States went back a long way. I mean, the founders were mostly, those who were Christians, were almost all Protestants, and they were very, very suspicious of the Catholics, and anti-Catholicism or anti-Catholic bigotry, or whatever you want to call it, is something that was very widely accepted in the United States, even fashionable, I would say, up until maybe the late 60s.
Well, he proved himself quite well, and to me, in that the Catholic Church never, ever came up during the term he was president, with the exception of the fact that he went to church each Sunday and was better for it.
The thing that horrified me in the context of Catholicism is that during the 2004 presidential election, there was a guy inside the office of, I forget what they call it now. It used to be, the office of the Inquisition, but it's something like the office of preserving the faith or something like that. He was the head of it. And he wrote a letter, sent a letter to all of the bishops in North America, in the United States, saying that to give communion to a politician who supports a woman's right to choose to have an abortion would be an abomination. It would be wrong. It would be a sin. And therefore, they shouldn't do that. And that guy, that cardinal who wrote that letter, is now the Pope and directly trying to interfere in a U.S. election. And that spooked me. But that's about as close to the, you know, my problems with the that's about it for my problems with the Catholic Church. I mean, I met Pope John Paul II. I was invited to go over to Castel Gandolfo, his summer palace, and went over and spoke with him briefly at his invitation. I didn't solicit it. And as a result, it was a result of a book that I had written. And I thought, you know, frankly, that he was a very decent man. He was certainly a very powerful man. But this new Pope Benedict, I just don't know. Two days ago, he made the comment about how I forget what the frame was, but he said this guy feared God more than he feared men, and therefore, they were elevating toward the status of sainthood an anti-Nazi German, and he said he feared God more than he feared men, and I thought, you know, that's interesting. I suspect that Pope John Paul II would have said he loved God more than he feared men.
Well, that's very good, yes.
But in any case, you know, yeah,
well,
interesting.
I just have one further comment, and I'll let
sure.
you know the other callers. And it's something very wonderful I heard the other day, and that was considering the plight of the American people. And, you know, and I'm a patriot, and I love my country. There's nothing better. And this person had said, you know, for an eagle to soar, it needs both a left wing and a right wing with its heart in the middle.
Yeah.
And I just think that sums up what this country really is about and what we need.
It's a nice metaphor.
It is.
It really is. Thank you. Thank you very much, Jerry, for sharing that with us. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. It's just, you know, and I think we really need to remember and listen to our founders. Thomas Jefferson, in June 5th, 1824, he wrote a letter to Major John Cartwright, who was a good friend of his, Major during the Revolutionary War, actually. They were both old men at the time that he wrote this letter. And Cartwright and he had been discussing whether or not the Bible had anything to do with American law, whether any, you know, American law was founded in biblical law. And in this letter, June 5th, 1824, to Major John Cartwright, he said, and I quote, "Our revolution commenced on more favorable ground than the foundation of English or biblical law. It presented us an album on which we were free to write what we pleased. We had no occasion to search into musty records, to hunt up royal parchments, or to investigate the laws and institutions of a semi-barbarous ancestry. We appealed to those of nature, and found them engraved in our hearts." Now, you'll recall in the Declaration of Independence, Jefferson said, you know, the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them. He was really big into this idea that divinity was to be found in nature, that it was not just in a church, that it was nature's God. And Adams, when he edited the Declaration of Independence, tried to change that to the Christian God. And Jefferson said, no, I'll have nothing to do with that. And Ben Franklin backed him up. And that's why the Declaration of Independence still talks about nature's God. It's a fascinating topic. Not something that we should dwell on particularly often, but, George W. Bush coming out and saying the reason why he's promoting Harriet Myers is because of the church she goes to. I'm sorry, it just gives me shivers. That is not the reason to put somebody on the Supreme Court, because of the church they go to. It just is not the reason. By the way, a couple of people have emailed asking, you know, where can I find those quotes? I think almost all of them are in my book, What Would Jefferson Do? You can easily find it. But you can find it online. Thanks so much for being with us. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.